Support for this podcast comes from San Francisco International Airport. At SFO, you can discover award-winning flavors and unique shops all before takeoff. Learn more about what's at SFO at flysfo.com.
Hey there, this is Brittany Luce from NPR's It's Been a Minute. KQED's podcasts like The Bay, Bay Curious, Mind Shift, Right Nowish, and more all tell the stories of the Bay and beyond with reliable, human-centered journalism. They aim to inspire, make you think, entertain, and expand your understanding of the place you call home. Here's how you can support podcasting at KQED.
Showing your support is easy, and you can join Brittany in supporting KQED Podcast too at donate.kqed.org/podcast. That's donate.kqed.org/podcast.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Alexis Madrigal. When we lose the people we love, do our conversations with them really end? Two of journalist Lisa Soap's friends died within the span of a couple years. And yet she found that her people had not simply disappeared, but found their way into her language and the language of their mutual friends. Her new book, Other People's Words, is a profound meditation on the first order experiences of life. Friendship, love, death. Carrying on in the face of great tragedy. This is a book to help you remember what is meaningful in this life. And we'll talk with Soap about this exceptional new work right after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. I'm not entirely sure how best to describe Lisa Soap's new book, Other People's Words. It's a remarkable piece of writing. It deals with themes of grief, friendship, the role of language in shaping our inner lives. And in some ways, it's completely out of step with the nonfiction being published today. It's not a memoir legoed together out of essays. It's not a self-help manual. Its primary concern is not a particular identity category or structural oppression. It's a book about how life happens. So it captures the achingly specific moments of life in which we find the people we care about most and then lose them. The comparisons I find myself reaching for are novelists of the highest caliber, Elena Ferrante, and maybe Sally Rooney too, because even when people in this book aren't being good to each other, man, they're trying. Lisa, thank you for this book, and thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Alexis, and thank you for those words.
This book really centers three couples. It's, you know, you and your husband, Chaz, Emily and her husband, Johnny, and perhaps the heart of the book, Mercy and Christine. We know by page two that Johnny and Christine will die, and also that it's going to include the Russian theorist Mikhail Bakhtin's ideas about language. But if I had to say what this book is about in just one word, it would be friendship.
Mm-hmm.
How did you see this book developing?
It's interesting. Friendship came later in the process in terms of my own understanding of what I was writing. So I 100% agree with you that friendship is the heart of the story. But I think I got to that story in different ways that maybe started more with loss and language. Mm. So I feel like I really started writing the book on my way home from my last visit with Christine when I knew I was there to say goodbye. Mm. Just to give a little bit of context, you know, well, the book is, as you say, about two friendships and about friendship itself as a great love and how I lost these two friends and then found them again and again through language. And in the case of Christine, her language changed over the course of an illness that for a long time was undiagnosed, unrecognized. Mm-hmm. So we had no explanation for what was happening to her, to her mind, to the way she was acting and feeling for a long time. Mm-hmm. And so by the end, once we knew what was happening and on this visit where she had so few words left, and yet I felt such tremendous presence of her voice. Mm. I needed to make sense of that. It wasn't what I expected when I knew I was going to see her and I was prepared for all the sadness and all the silence. And that was there. Sadness and silence were there. Mm-hmm. And there was this kind of rush of this sense of her presence and her everything she'd said and this feeling of conversation between us. And so I started there, I think, trying to understand that feeling. But as I understood that I wanted to tell the story of Christine interlaced with the story of Johnny, and I realized that what the story I was telling was a story of friendship.
Why don't you read for us this remarkable introduction to Mercy, mm-hmm. which who was Christine's partner and is mm-hmm. how you sort of met Christine.
Right.
If you need to set it up, you can set it up at all, but you're in grad school mm-hmm. in the late 90s.
Grad school in the late 90s. I think that I'm pretty sure that the passage does set it up.
Yeah,
so maybe I'll just go ahead and read it. Mercy and I were in our 20s when we met in a grad school class in 1996. She was working on a master's in education, and I was in the same department for my PhD. It was fall in the Bay Area, and she was deeply tan. Mercy worshipped the sun, still does. Her black hair was cropped short and pushed up from her forehead in the front. She wore a soft white t-shirt with brown stitching around the collar, and if it sounds like I was attracted to her, yes. A thin brass bracelet slid up her arm when she raised her hand to ask a question. She asked a lot of questions. I watched her from across the seminar room and found myself thinking about her outside of class. I was food shopping or dozing off partway through a reading, and my mind went to her brash intellect and the taut muscles that flexed up and down her forearms when she wrote. After we started getting lunch sometimes, I noticed the way she asked me unexpected questions and seemed taken by my answers, how our eyes met when someone in the class made a pretentious comment, how a weathered leather belt sat low across the expanse of her hips. Soon there was that feeling, nervous, gorgeous, and rare, the sense of choosing and being chosen. And it didn't take long for me to realize that Mercy was someone lots of people fell in love with. I did and didn't, for two reasons. One, I was already with Chaz. Two, she told me about Christine.
That was Lissa Soap reading from her book, Other People's Words, Friendship Loss and the Conversations That Never End. And as you read, you know, you do hear someone falling in love. Mm-hmm. What's fascinating is that as couples, you two came together and became something even more rare, you know, beautiful and maybe not quite nameable. This is one of these kind of coupledoms.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it was a time in our lives, I think. We were as it says here, in our 20s, and there was this just sense of possibility and kind of like brimming, right? Mm-hmm. Like just kind of you're trying to figure out who you are, and you figure that out through relationships, and relationships have lots of layers, and some of it's spoken and some of it's unspoken and some of it's just inside your mind and some of it's shared. And everything felt very kind of dynamic, you know, and so as Mercy and I got to know each other pretty early in that process, it was my birthday coming up, and we decided to get together at the right spot, which is a marvelous place, not far from where we're sitting in the studio. Mm-hmm. And that's when I met Christine. And actually, it's important to say Christine was 20 years older than the rest of us. So the three of us were in our 20s, but Christine was not. And that, I think, gave her this sort of mystery, and which she already would have had, a kind of like mm-hmm. charisma.
Gravitas.
Like, yeah, and reserve and just I you know, what was it like for her to like hang out with these 20-somethings, you know?
Occasionally annoying, but also invigorating.
Exactly.
I think we can guess. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so, yeah, this was a time where once pretty immediately when we hung out that first time and I saw the intimacy between Mercy and Christine and what they shared, and I felt the relationship I was in with Chaz and the fact that we all kind of sparked, mm-hmm. right? And so things kind of aligned and realigned, and we orchestrated ourselves into, like you said, this sort of four-way friendship that really felt at the time and looking back, like a great love of our lives, yeah. even though it didn't last, not only because Christine died, but because Mercy and Christine broke up.
Yeah, and time moved on. Yeah, yeah. You know, you quote Wallace Stegner in the book, mm-hmm. you know, about friendship, that it is a, this is Stegner speaking here, it is a relationship that has no formal shape. There are no rules or mm-hmm. obligations or bonds, as in marriage or the family. It's held together by neither law nor property nor blood. There is no glue in it, but mutual liking. It is mm-hmm. therefore rare.
I love that line.
what a quote, right? To describe, well, and I think it describes a lot of like chosen family yeah. style relationships, particularly in queer and queer adjacent communities, yeah. where people just say like, well, yeah, no, we're family because we like each other that much,
mm-hmm,
you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He had another image, this like headquarters for our happiness. Mm-hmm. And so I sometimes think of that idea of headquarters too. Like, mm-hmm. what are the like headquarters in our lives for when we can come together with the people we love, with our family, with, you know, the people we experience as our family, and mm-hmm. just how, yeah, as you said, how precious that is. Yeah.
And because it will be crucial later in this conversation and also in the book, Mercy and Christine, right, both are in an incredibly literary relationship.
Yeah.
Writing like an astonishing to me sense a number of letters and a kind of level of literary output that you don't really experience a lot anymore, I think.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, Christine was old-fashioned in that way, in the sense that she really held back on using technology. And she did at the end, towards the end, when she needed to. But they wrote, you know, handwritten letters almost every night, you know, after they would eat. They're both teachers, so they would, after dinner, they would be marking up their students' papers. So they were deeply, deeply involved mm-hmm. in their students' writing, and to the point that they would, like, send, you know, like, we would be reading, let's say, Arundhati Roy, and they would have done an assignment in their classes where a student was writing something gorgeous about Arundhati Roy. And so then Christine would, you know, put her notes in the margins and send Chaz and me, like, the notes and something she wrote. And then her letter would have, like, random capital letters like Arundhati Roy did. So there was a lot of that going on. And, you know, I guess maybe it sounds like a teeny bit pretentious, maybe, but it felt very, like, lived at the time. It felt very, it didn't feel like that. It felt like it was just, you know, these were the great stories around us. Mm. And she, and particularly Christine, but Mercy too, would sort of, yeah. like, write into them as a daily practice.
I mean, I have an older friend, Mary, who writes me emails that I cherish, because it's rare that someone takes the time to actually record their life and times in a way that they know will be interesting to you, right?
Yeah.
That is connected to you. I don't know. It makes the world feel a little more tractable, I think.
Yeah.
How about Emily and Johnny, the other couple mm-hmm. in this story? I mean, how did you come to know them?
So I met Emily through her cousin. I mean, it's funny. Her cousin is both the person who yeah. introduced yeah. me to Emily and also to Chaz. Ah. So Emily and I became friends also when we were in our 20s. We lived in the same place for a year before we went our separate ways for a little bit, and then came back together mm-hmm. in San Francisco when she'd met Johnny.
And they were, and they got married, and
they married.
Became very close friends.
Super close friends, yeah.
We're talking with Lissa Soap about her book, Other People's Words, Friendship, Loss, and Conversations That Never End. This is a really great book, and it deals a lot with conversations, as it says in the title, that don't end. Conversations with people that you've lost, the ones that you can still have even when they're not there. If you understand that experience or you've had something like that, give us a call. The number is 866-733-6786. Maybe you saved a voicemail. Maybe you just have those conversations on your own. Maybe you've got letters or emails. You could share those with us. You can email forum@kqed.org, or again, the number is 866-733-6786. We'll be back with more on the book Other People's Words, Friendship Loss, and Conversations That Never End right after the break.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're talking with Lissa Soep about her book, Other People's Words, Friendship Loss, and the Conversations That Never End. You know, right before the break, we were talking about these friends, Emily and Johnny, very tight friends you had here in San Francisco. And then, in like, the definition of kind of a freak accident befalls this family.
Johnny and Emily went to Montana because something tragic had already happened to their family. Emily's stepfather had been hiking and fell off the side of the path, and he didn't survive the fall. So Emily and Johnny, with their kids, went to this lake in Montana to gather with their loved ones. And Johnny was training for a triathlon at the time. And so he went for a swim in the lake, in the same lake that Emily had, you know, grown up swimming in with her sister, and a boat was going too fast and ran over him while he was swimming, and he didn't survive that accident.
Oh. And just the kind of thing you can't expect.
No.
The kind of thing that you must just think, you know, if I did that a million times,
right,
would never happen. So how did the family try to deal with that? I mean, they had two little kids, right, who were young.
Yeah. I can only share like what I saw. And I know there are dimensions of that experience that I can never know, you know, that Emily and her children have gone through, and others who were part of Johnny's family. I can share what it felt like as a friend, you know, a really devoted and beloved friend to both of them. I picked up, you know, Emily at the airport and her kids, and I spent the first couple of nights that they were in the Bay Area. They came from Montana to the Bay Area because Johnny's family is here. Some of his family is here, and Emily's sister, who she's really close to. And I just, you know, remember, you know, I had this instinct when I saw them. You know, I went to the San Francisco airport, and, you know, they had to wait for Johnny's bag to come. I mean, just all this, and just, you can't quite wrap your head around what's happening. And I had this instinct to start telling stories about John, you know, to like, we were in the elevator. I remember being in like an elevator, I think, at the airport, and wanting to start telling Emily something that I remembered about Johnny or what, you know. And she just kind of stopped me and said, I can't, like, I can't fall asleep. I can't fall apart right now. And so I think, you know, she had no choice but to carry on. And she has a really loving community that rallied around her. And yet, in many ways, you know, only she could sort of navigate from there.
What did you take away from the relationship that she maintained, that you observed with Johnny? Like, how did she maintain that?
Yeah. I'm so glad you're asking the question, because I said one moment that sort of where I started writing this book was on the flight home from seeing Christine for the last time. Another moment when I realized that I started to sort of notice, you know,
these kind of parallels. Or
I mean,
connection.
Johnny died first, but, you know, that Emily wrote to Johnny. Emily writes too. I mean, Emily's a beautiful writer and a artist and a therapist. And so she had an instinct. I mean, from the very beginning, she said, even in the days, you know, and weeks after he died, she said, where is he? You know, really, where is he? Like, I'm really asking that question, you know? And then I think part of how she answered that question for herself was she would write to him. And she continued to write to him. And she shared some of what she wrote with me. And so I think, which was a really trusting thing to do, you know, to share that kind of where she was in that grief process. And so she just had to keep, like, you know, conversations mm-hmm. needed to continue. She harvested every kind of relic or artifact of his voice that she could, every text message. She had all the voicemails mm. that he had left for her, kept them on a file, you know, so mm. just really knowing that she was going to have to find any voice of his that was left for a lifetime of conversations mm. going forward, both for her and her children. And so I think, and then, you know, I just want to, if it's okay, there's just one, when you ask that question mm. of like, how did she carry on and keep Johnny close. There was a moment, I don't exactly know when it was after mm-hmm. he died, but mm-hmm. months, or within the first year.
Yeah.
And she went out to brunch with a friend, her friend Julie. And Julie said to her at one point after catching up on how the kids are doing and the usual, she said, "There's something I've been wanting to ask you. How's Johnny?" And Emily just, you know, stopped and was like, "Thank you for asking." And I write about that moment in the book because I think the something so subtle, which is the tense that yeah. Julie thought to use, you know, "How is Johnny?" was such a recognition of the present tenseness of Emily's relationship with Johnny and how that you know, allowed her to be seen in a way that maybe some of us who are close to people who are experiencing that level of grief, like, don't always go mm-hmm. there. And I think that that's another way that just was revealed to me as I was yeah. trying to stay close, that was such an important recognition.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely does make me think of, you know, my own tight relationships, you know, particularly my parents. It's like they are alive, you know, in the world, thankfully still, mm-hmm. but they're also alive just like in me.
Yeah.
Right. I could talk with them anytime I wanted to, you know, in my own mind, and I could have a full conversation. In fact, maybe most of my conversation with my parents are like that.
Totally.
I want to bring in Beverly, who has a story for us. Welcome, Beverly in Berkeley.
Hi. Thank you. I just wanted to say the way I keep my mother's memory alive is I have her favorite fragrance that I smell that sometimes when I'm in meditation, it just comes to me.
Oh, wow.
And I have a video of her at her 90th birthday party. She lived to be 98 and was lived it fully, but very vibrant. And at her 90th birthday party, she had on a beautiful gown, and she's from New Orleans. And so she was dancing. And so having a good time. And so I have that video on my phone.
Mm-hmm.
And there, when I miss her, I look at that video, and I also have, you know, notes from her or envelopes from her with her handwriting on it. And I just look at those, and that just brings her fully present to me. Just watching her dance just reminds me of how it was the right thing to let her go and that she lived a really full, wonderful life.
Beverly, do you have any recordings of her voice you ever listen to?
Yes, I have. I saved a couple of voice messages. I wish I'd saved more of them, and I listen to those, and it just where she'll call and she'd say, "Hey, baby, I don't want to keep you." And so I listen to those, and sometimes I share them on a family thread, but it just touches me to see her handwriting and to look at her dance and to hear her voice on the voicemail, and I wished I'd kept more of them.
Oh, Beverly, thank you so much for sharing that with us. And I can feel the warmth just in that. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
I want to go to another caller, and then I'll come back to you on both these, Lissa. Vita in San Anselmo, welcome.
Hi there. I'm so happy you're having this conversation. And
Beverly, thank you so much for sharing that.
Oh, just got to turn down the radio. There you go.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. Crazy mistake. Anyway, my friend passed away in 1999, and we were college buddies, and we used to, when I moved to California, he used to send me a tape, cassette tape, every week. So we passed along these cassette tapes, and I ran across three of them just recently. So it was such a wonderful thing to hear his voice and hear about random stories, you know, just everyday life. you know, just talking about going to the bar, or going to school, or talking about who's at work. And it was just like, and now, you know, when I think of him, I think of the bigger stories that we would talk about. What would he think about, you know, Donald Trump and those sorts of things? But it was just great to take me back to the real basics. And now I'm putting together a video with the voiceover from the cassette and all the images that he sent me. So I can share it on YouTube for everybody. And I was so broken up when, just one final thing, I was so sad when he passed away that I put his photos, two framed images of him in the closet. And just so they were there, they were, I could still see them, but, you know, they were kind of hidden away from daily life. Mm. And now, 25 years later, I'm just so thankful that that's the first thing that I look at.
Mm. Oh, Vida. Mm. Hey, thank you for sharing that. I love keeping the memory alive in that way. I mean, you hear these stories. What's it make you think of?
Oh, gosh. Well, I thank you, callers, for such beautiful words and images and offerings. I am thinking about something that I write about in the book. There's Cord Jefferson, who now is a movie director, but has also been a writer and did this beautiful story that I saw performed about his voicemails that he kept from his mother. Mm-hmm. This utterly mundane message about, where should she stay, at an Airbnb or at a hotel, right? And then when she was diagnosed with cancer and ultimately died, that message became the single most, you know, important thing, possession that he had, I think is roughly what he said. And there's echoes of that in what I write about in the way that Emily experiences the voicemails that Johnny left behind. And it, like the caller said, Johnny always opened his voicemails by saying, "Hey, sugar." And she played them back to me after he died, and we sat together, and I felt, you know, like he was almost talking to us or talking to Emily, and I was able to listen in two dimensions or something. And I don't mean that in a woo-woo sense, but I just mean like you could hear him in that everyday life, like we're saying, mm-hmm. just, you know, hey.
The presentness of it.
Yeah, like I'm putting Max in the bath, or wish you were here, or sorry I'm not there, you know. And then you hear it as a, you know, like what it means and how it feels for that, those same words to come after he's gone. But the hey sugar still feeling like, well, he's still checking on her, you know, as, you know, like we said, there's still, that dynamic is still there. So those are some of the things that I'm thinking about listening to what you all have shared.
I want to return to Mercy and Christine's story. This part of the book, I feel like if you are someone who loves words, as Christine did, as I do, as many of our listeners do, it's really difficult to read about someone who kind of loses control of language in this way. Pick up from the sort of love story of Mercy and Christine, this like wonderful couple. What ends up happening?
Yeah, so, you know, Christine started to behave in ways that didn't totally line up with who she normally was and how she normally was. And at first, as I said, because there was this age gap between us, we were like, and I can say this now, maybe it's menopause, you know, like we didn't know what was going on. And she was so hyper, you know, kind of verbal that she could cover a lot of things that I think were probably happening inside and that she didn't share in terms of changes and in the way her mind was operating. And it got to the point where so much, you know, she had retreated so far from their relationship that at some point, you know, they were traveling together and Mercy rolled over and turned to Christine and said, "Where are you?" Mm. And it created, I think, enough space between them that Mercy ultimately met somebody else and the relationship ended. And it was totally devastating, first and foremost for them, but also for Chaz and me, because like we said, you know, this was like a core relationship of our lives. Mm. So we felt kind of betrayed and hurt and at sea that they were coming apart the way they did. And it went on like that for a long time. And Christine, who'd always been a writer, as we've said, constantly communicating, it picked up, if anything. And she did at a certain point get emails. So it would be like multiple emails a day. And the writing started changing and her sentences started sort of becoming more fragments and her punctuation just kind of like scattered across her writing, you know, like lines of exclamation points. And this was a woman, you need to you know, it was like very reserved and sort of disciplined in her writing. She never used an exclamation point. Like Christine was not an exclamation point kind of
no lulls
person, yeah, right? Yeah, yeah. And suddenly it was just like, you know, even just visually when you saw them, they looked like really different. Mm. And I thought it was heartbreak for a long time. I just thought this was just this heartbreak she was not getting over. And then she also started like pursuing Mercy in ways that she never would have, like really, you know, kind of not respecting Mercy's boundaries. And over time it got so pronounced that, and as I said, she was a teacher, that some things happened at school where the people at school were concerned and insisted that she get testing. And at that, and that was when she was evaluated for and it was revealed that she had cognitive decline, and and then it kind of continued from there. And all through it, she wrote.
She wrote. Meanwhile, she also burned the letters that Mercy had sent her, right? Let's bring in Marilyn in San Jose. Welcome, Marilyn.
Hi. My family found a box of letters after my uncle died of my grandmother that was labeled "Letters, Please Burn."
Oh my God.
That's like the most enticing intro you could ever have.
Right, but nobody read the letters. Everybody respected it. I couldn't believe it once it landed in my mailbox from my cousin. And so this is 80 years after they were written in the 1940s around World War II, of which they were love letters between my grandma and grandpa before they got married. And my grandpa had been accepted a job in California. They lived in Detroit, and he drove out to California, and he wrote all these beautiful letters of his adventures and getting out to Alameda and working, and so much pre-World War II stuff was going on, and at the same time declaring his love for my grandma and when are you going to come out, and planning their marriage and not telling the family, and talking about birth control at that point.
A few
letters of description of physical love, of which I guess that's why Please Burn was on the...
I mean, talk about getting to know your grandparents in a totally different way. I mean, I think...
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Marilyn, thank you so much for sharing that story with us. You know, I think there is something, right, Lissa, in the way that letters and words and kind of the literature of everyday life can reach across, you know, these like vast chasms, right? It's not the memoir they wrote. It's the letters they wrote to each other in daily life, just these everyday words that people share.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that, I mean, oh my God, what an incredible story.
What a story.
Yeah. And, you know, in other people's words, there's a box like that, right? Well, there were several boxes like that. So Christine sent Chaz and me, I don't know, two or three boxes of things that when she was needing to move out of her place, and they were things that were too kind of tender and too connected to Mercy for her to throw away, but also she couldn't keep them around her. And so we received these boxes of all these kind of like artifacts of their lives and our life together. You know, there were things in there that we had all shared, but there was one, I think maybe two boxes that she saved for Mercy. And like the caller said, that Christine labeled them "For M When I'm Gone."
Oh.
And Mercy, it took a long time for Mercy to open those boxes and really look at them. And it was recent that she that she was able to really go in. You know, she sort of glanced, but then she closed the box and shoved it deep, deep, deep in the basement so she wouldn't, you know, stumble across it while she was doing the laundry. And then it took a really long time for her to open up those boxes.
Maybe you can tell us what's in the boxes after the break. We're talking with Lissa Soap about her fantastic new book. It's called Other People's Words, Friendship, Loss, and the Conversations That Never End. And of course, we'd love to hear from you about the conversations you've had with people you've lost. The number is 866-733-6786. forum at kqed.org. We'll be back with more right after the break.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're talking with Lissa Soap about her new book, Other People's Words, Friendship, Loss, and the Conversations That Never End. You know, listener Caroline writes, my dad died 5 years ago, and my family and I still ask each other regularly, what's Parp doing now? And we know exactly what he's doing, even though he's not here. We also ask him questions or say that the next time we see him, we'll ask him.
Wow.
It is amazing that people are keep alive their loved ones in all these different ways that we've been hearing about this morning and that you detail in the book. There's actually another character in this book who we haven't really talked about though, and who I think helps make sense of why this works, why this is the way we are. It's someone you might not expect. It's Russian theorist Mikhail Bakhtin. Talk to us about him, how he became such an important part of your real and actual life, not like kind of an academic formulation.
Yeah. So he's the character in the book who was already dead by the time I met him. And actually, interestingly, Mercy and I met him together. We were in one of those grad school classes. We studied Bakhtin.
Dialogic imagination, exactly the book you think you'll need for grief later in life.
No, yeah. Right? Yeah. No idea that his theory of language would become kind of a lifeline for me and so personal when initially I did encounter it in an academic context and I was writing a dissertation. But truthfully, I think there was something that connected with me on a deeper level even then. And there's a line from Bakhtin where he says, our speech is filled to overflowing with other people's words. So he's a philosopher of language. He also studied literature and wrote a lot about literature, about Dostoevsky and others. And he was obsessed with dialogue, hence the dialogic imagination, but not dialogue in the way we usually think about it, not dialogue between people. He was always tuning into dialogue within people. So this sort of like vibration of other people's words that is always present in our own speech. So he would even sort of, I think, question the idea that there is such a thing as like my own speech. If we relate to my own speech as something that is uniquely mine, that's kind of a monologue that I, you know, either is inside my head or I'm expressing in the world, that's almost a fiction, right? And in fact, it's always a conversation because I don't get Bakhtin wrote this. I don't get my words from a dictionary. I don't produce them for within myself. They are a product of the relationships and histories and sort of echoes of all of the conversations.
All of the language.
All of the language. And frankly, Bakhtin would say all of the languages, right?
Yeah,
because there's multiple language systems that, not to get too kind of like, you know, linguistic, but you know that it's that deep. You know, it was that deep for him.
And so we actually have a passage for you to read.
Okay.
That I think gets at many of these things. Do you wanna read it?
Sure.
Yeah.
Our speech is filled to overflowing with other people's words, Bakhtin wrote, and I sensed that this was an idea I could live by. A way to understand how intimacy and conflict take root within speech. A vibration that's always there. I listen to a singer covering another artist's song and experience both of their voices at once, a devotional chord. I say something and hear my mother in the cadence, or Chaz does and looks vaguely panicked. Bakhtin was obsessed with dialogue, and so am I. We both listen for it, not just in the usual sense of conversation between people, but in the many voices that lace through a single person's words. Like many of Bakhtin's contemporaries, he was interested in language as a system, but Bakhtin stood out for his attention to the particularities, the textures and accents that distinguish our voices. He noticed how a novel's narrator can pick up vocal patterns from its protagonists, how the author's own voice can shimmer in and out of the text without overtly announcing itself. He saw these same qualities in ordinary speech, too, calling them instances of double voicing. To me, this is more than an idea. It is a liberation. Because, do you want me to keep reading?
Yeah, just that last bit.
Okay. It's really good. Because once we accept that no one absolutely possesses even their own speech, that it's filled to overflowing with the words of others, then voices and texts that were once closed crack open. They are capacious and mysterious, alive with new interpretations. I am always saying more than the words that come out of my mouth. I can always find new meanings in what others say to me. When a loved one's voice diminishes or goes silent, after a relationship is destroyed or someone dies, I still carry the voice and keep hearing it.
Is Lissa Soap reading from her book, Other People's Words, Friendship, Loss, and the Conversations That Never End. Just such a beautiful way of kind of thinking about our relations with everyone in the world, you know, that you can't help it, that you will be influenced. This is in the very nature of language to keep each other alive long after we've passed.
Yeah. And it's not, you know, I think the kind of what Bakhtin called this double voicing, I think it comes into relief in times of loss when the voices we need are missing. But it's really always there, you know, so I talk about, like, you know, hearing my mother's voice kind of like show up, you know, in how I'm interacting with my own kids, or, you know, it comes up sometimes, I think, around, like, I thought about it a lot when Chaz and I were in couples therapy, and, like, you know, you're like, suddenly there's this, like, third voice that's, you know, it's kind of embarrassing, and you're, like, trying out this different language, and, you know, so it's that's one of the things that was kind of mind-blowing to me, is that it's, like, it's always there.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I loved about that couples therapy session, you know, listeners may have heard, we had the Gottmans on, you know, like, legendary couples therapists, and you kind of need to repeat back the other person's words to both to prove that you've understood, but there's also something I think that happens that when we say the other person's words in our voice, we do gain a new understanding of what they're trying to say.
Right.
Even if we've heard it, even if we know exactly what they meant, that you saying it, putting, you know, borrowing those words for that time does do something different.
Yeah. And you know, this is maybe a little bit of a leap, but I'm thinking about Christine as we're talking, and just the idea that, you know, when her language changed and when she was sort of deeper into her illness, you know, the idea that both voices were there and I needed to encounter and experience the fullness and poetry, both in the remembered voice and the present voice, this different voice, and the, you know, increasingly, you know, minimal voice in terms of what she could say verbally or speaking, but just to sort of, I think there's also something in this idea of, you know, the capaciousness.
Our own multiple voices,
right? I mean, in that sense, she's no different than any of the rest of us, you know, where there's different versions of the voice that make up who we are and how we show up and the people we love.
So interesting. Let's bring in some more callers who want to share some stories. Susan in Palo Alto, welcome.
Oh, thank you. I just wanted to say that my husband was Irish, and he passed away peacefully at home. We spent 50 years together in love and friendship. And being Irish, he was an amazing writer and talker. And on special occasions, we didn't give gifts. He would write me short stories, and they were often accompanied by drawings. So 4 years ago when he passed away, I brought hundreds of these down, as he was at home when he died peacefully. And I sat at the end of the bed, and for a week, I read every single one of them to him.
Oh, my God.
And I still have them, and every day I read them.
Oh. Susan, that's so beautiful. We're just choked up here in the studio.
Well, he was special, and I have sheaths and sheaths of these, wow. And I still read them every day, and they're so, so important to me.
Wow. Gosh, Susan, thank you.
Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, wow. Thank you for sharing that with everybody.
Wow.
God, what a beautiful... You know, it's like some you could have a bracelet, you could have flowers that would be gone in a week, or you could have stories that 45 years on would be read back to you as you were, crossing over.
Yeah.
Man, Susan, thank you so much for that. Let's bring in Liana in Oakland.
I'm also choked up from that last story.
Gosh, Susan, I know.
Yeah. Wow. I have had two of my best friends die, and when Lisa Donnelly died, I built an ancestor altar inside of my home, and it's a place where we've kept objects and photos of me and my housemates, of people that we've loved and lost. And then when Sean McCabe died, somebody who started the You're Going to Die community here in the Bay Area, Ned Buskirk, he offered us a writing seminar. And so a group of us got together on a weekly basis for a period of time, and we wrote through our grief, our anger, our frustration, our sadness, and it was such an immense and beautiful experience for all of us. And Sean was an actor, part of an immersive theater group, and so we have kept the characters that he used to play alive and reincorporated them into the stories and shows.
Liana, what a beautiful thing. For folks looking for that kind of support, the group in the Bay was called You're Going to Die. Thank you. Thank you so much, Liana. You know, listen, one of the things that both these calls have kind of made me think of, you know, the reference to the ancestor altar and kind of the writing and storytelling of Irish folks, it's just kind of that other cultures do seem to have ways of incorporating these voices. Other cultures kind of seem to have a better scripts maybe for talking with our loved ones once they've moved on. This seemed to be one that you found, though, right? That this specific kind of understanding of other people's words coming through you.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was, I think, organic in that sense, right? Like, I think it comes by necessity when you are at that loss for the love that you, you know, are missing and needing, that you find what you look for what you've got. And sometimes these boxes in our basements or these, you know, piles of notes and letters, they contain, or the voicemails, they contain what we need.
Another listener writes, God, these stories are amazing. I met Brian in my freshman year of University of Michigan in 1967. We shared a love of literature, mysticism, Jewish folklore. He's a prolific writer and romantic, and we traveled in 1969-70 to Paris to seek out the haunts of Henry Miller. Later in the early 70s, I was married, and Brian and I sent a huge number of letters back and forth. He continued sending copious long letters to me beyond my ability to comprehend or return their intensity. He saved everything, and after he died in 2015, after having experienced a form of dementia near the end, his brother sent me a huge box of all the letters I had written to Brian, which he had saved. I had saved all his letters to me, and I was amazed at the breadth and depth of his relationships.
Wow.
Let's bring in Alexandra in San Anselmo. Welcome, Alexandra.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. This is an incredible program. I'm deeply touched, very emotional, thinking about all of the ways in which voices are kind of weaving through me, past voices of people who've died. My 16-year-old and 13-year-old were rummaging around my dad's home a couple weeks ago and found a box of cassette tapes. And we bought a little cassette player because none of us had one anymore. And we started playing them, and we discovered a few tapes that I just wanted to share. One was, I remember I grew up in the 70s in San Francisco, and all through the 70s and 80s, my family of origin lives in Greece. We discovered cassette tapes of what my family used to do is put a recorder on the dining room table in Greece.
Wow.
And just invite friends over and have conversations.
Wow.
Not directly about us or to us, but they would just put the recorder on so as if we were there. And every month, they'd send us a recording, and then we would do the same thing. And I remember that probably until I was about 10. Every month we'd have to sit in front of the recorder and just have a normal dinner conversation that we would then send to them.
What a beautiful thing.
And it was, Yeah, it was incredible. And so just listening to that, I was just in a pool of tears, just remembering that because I'd forgotten. Mm-hmm. But then there was one tape in particular that we found. So growing up in the 80s and early 90s in San Francisco, 80% of our friends were really affected by the AIDS epidemic. And we lost about, 70%, 75% of our friends. And there was one tape in particular that we listened to that of a dear friend who knew he was dying. And on his deathbed, he decided to buy a whole box of cassette tapes and make recordings for each of his beloveds. And he wrote it with his words and with just listening to his actual voice. I had never heard the tape, but he dedicated a wish and a blessing for each of us. And I just, hearing his voice just brought us back in time. And it was speaking to each of us, knowing that he was about to die. And it was the biggest gift I could ever have asked for.
Wow.
Yeah.
Alexandra, thank you so much for sharing that, too. You know, listen, one of the things that I think you hear in all these calls, you hear it in the comments that are coming in, it's laced all throughout your book. We hear so much about people being terrible to each other, you know, like that's so much of what media is about, things, bad people doing bad things. And yet all these stories are about just like beautiful things people have done for each other over the years.
Yeah.
And they do it in your book, too. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. And the book is not without hurt. I mean,
people
hurt each other in the book and around the book. And, you know, so it's both. Right. I mean, I hope that's part of what comes through, or it's maybe just how I've lived it is like, you know, you can survive hurt too, and, you know, and see it for what it is and process it and work through it and then find your way towards, you know, a different relationship too.
It's in your book, right? The Bakhtin line about, poems must have the feel of death and loss in them, or they're not a poem, right?
Or their stupid rapture, I think he said, or something.
Rapture.
I think that's right. What he said.
I think that is what it was. I think that is what it was. Yeah, and I thought that was such a...
I love that too.
Right, that's part of it, along with all the difficult things that people are doing. They're trying to make amends, they're trying to repair, and we do find Mercy come back to Christine at the end.
Yeah.
And it's one of the most amazing set pieces that I've read in a book is her sending you all the things that she found in that closed box, right?
Yeah. I don't want to give it all away. There was such a revelation to Mercy and to me in real time what was in that box is, I guess, what I'll say. As I said, she had opened the box before and she referenced it at Christine's memorial service, some of the things that were in there. Christine had left her birth certificate she gave to Mercy.
The ultimate, I was here.
I was here. I existed, right? My life began and I lived on this earth, right? And then, you know, Christine adored her cat who died. And so she left the paper from the euthanasia of the bill to pay when Bad Kitty had to go down, and a picture of herself playing rugby when her hair was still brown and, you know, muscling another girl out of the way towards the ball. And, you know, but there were other things in those boxes that Mercy had no idea and that had been buried and she hadn't accessed until this kind of moment between the two of us when she was just texting me like what she was finding. And it was opening up discoveries for her that really changed her understanding of what was happening at the end of Christine's life.
Gosh. Do yourself a favor, everyone. Read this new book. It's Other People's Words, Friendship, Loss, and the Conversations That Never End. Author, of course, has been talking with us this morning. Lissa Soep, thank you so much.
Thank you, Alexis, and thank you, everyone who called in.
Yeah. We got Angel in San Jose. Just want to let you know we're thinking about you. I couldn't get to your call. Another listener writes in to say, when I'd visit my mom in New York, we'd sit at the kitchen table doing the jumble. She'd do the words, and I'd solve the puzzle. She passed away 2 years ago. I still do it every day, and I say out loud, thanks, Mom. Thank you to everyone. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for another hour ahead with Mina Kim.
Thank you. Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising Simons Foundation.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.